General relativity is our current theory of gravity that we use on all scales. We use that in all areas of astrophysics and cosmology, and it's the underlying theory that we have to work with at this point. It turns out that general relativity is actually not very well tested, and it is an assumption that is many times made that we just simply have to make. And in this talk, I'm going to show you a little bit about what we know about general relativity so far, and I'm going to show you a framework within which we can test general relativity in a regime which simply has not been tested before. So in this project, which I've been working on for some time, before I really get into this, I would like to mention some of my collaborators. First of all, this is going to be Dimitrios Psaltis, who was my thesis advisor at Arizona. And then there are a number of people who will show up at several points during the talk. And all of these have contributed to all the good things that I'm going to tell you about today. So let me jump into the outline of what I want to talk about today. First of all, general relativity. Many times you hear, well, general relativity, that's very well tested, so it's a done deal. But that's actually not true. And I'm going to show you a little bit about what we have tested so far, and then how we can take it to the next level, which is performing tests of general relativity in the strong field regime. Then I'm going to show you how we can do this with a number of astrophysical tests, and finally, a little bit about the future, the kind of things that we expect to see with upcoming instruments within the next few years. So first of all, general relativity has been tested in the weak field regime. And I'm going to specify this a little bit more clearly what this actually means. But what people have done over for several decades now is performing tests of general relativity primarily in the solar system. And here I'm just going to show you one of the avenues how this works. For this, you use the so-called PPN formalism, which stands for parameterized post-Newtonian. You take Newtonian gravity and you simply add the next order corrections to this, and you put a free parameter in front of that. And then you perform experiments which measures this parameter, and you see whether you find the exact value that this parameter has in general relativity or not. And here I'm demonstrating this for some simple metric, which is some spherically symmetric metric, which is what people usually use for everything in the solar system. And you can parameterize this in this form where you introduce these parameters, beta and gamma. These parameters are one in general relativity. So for example, this term here, the next to leading order term in this in the time component here does not show up in general relativity. But you can simply add an expansion in mass over radius, so this is what this is, and you just put this coefficient in front of it. And at this term here, the radial element, you can do the same thing. And if you just set them equal to zero, then you arrive at Newtonian gravity. If you put them equal to one, then you have general relativity. If you have anything else, then you see a deviation from general relativity. This approach only works, well, up to this order, because that's how it is defined. But that is all you need for tests in the solar system. And here I'm illustrating two particular tests. One of them is, of course, the light bending. This was the very first test of general relativity, where you have stars that are very close to the sun, but behind the sun. And the light that is emitted by these stars is bent around the sun. One successful prediction of general relativity. And then by measuring this deflection, you are able to infer these parameters. Another way you can do this, and here this is the Cassini spacecraft, you can measure the time delay. Suppose there's a signal which is sent, well, either way, it has to pass, and if it passes by the sun, it has to pass through this potential well here. And there is a time delay because it takes an extra time, a little bit longer compared to how long it would take in flat space. And these two effects have been very well measured. This is the final figure for this, starting with, so this is for the light deflection and for the time delay, which is also called the Shapiro time delay, starting with optical measurements with huge uncertainties, but look at the time scale here. So this was in the 1920s. These were the original experiments done by Eddington on an expedition to look at a solar eclipse. And nowadays, this has been done a lot more precisely. Now people do this in the radio. and even use VLBI techniques. So VLBI stands for very long baseline interferometry. You can couple together several radio telescopes and use them as one big telescope, as one interferometer. And what they did, they simply observed two quasars who passed behind the sun at some point a couple of years ago. And from this, they made a very precise measurement, which showed that this gamma parameter is very close to one. And then the same deal for this Shapiro time delay, the Cassini mission, which was sent to Saturn, made this kind of measurement, again, measuring gamma to a value which is very close to unity. If you want to measure this parameter beta, then you have to do another test. You have to watch the precession of the perihelion of Mercury in Newtonian gravity. If you put a planet next to the sun, it's just going to orbit on an ellipse. But if you introduce the next to Newtonian order corrections, the ellipse is no longer closed and it slowly precesses. This is a very small effect. And actually the biggest effect that you see for this is the perturbation from other planets. And here are the numbers. If you look at the precession over here, so this is in arc seconds per century, from other planets, this is, it's still small, but that's what the number is. The prediction from general relativity is only this, about 43 arc seconds per century. So this is very small. But it turns out that this has actually been measured and coincides very well. So it's in good agreement with the value that is observed. And you can even make this a little bit more precise if you do this with lunar laser ranging. So here what people do is they send a laser signal to the moon and back. And there is an effect, which is called the Nordfeld effect, which predicts that there is a slight difference in the travel time due to a violation of what is called the weak equivalence principle. This essentially means that the gravitational and the inertial mass can be different, and this can be a very small effect, but is not excluded by current laboratory experiments. So in any way, people have done this experiment, they found no deviation of that sort, and then you find this value which is in good agreement. So that is what we have so far. There is one test that probed a different aspect of general relativity in the weak field regime, and that is Gravity Probe B. Gravity Probe B was a satellite that was launched a while ago, and it orbited around the Earth on an orbit that looked like this, crossing the two poles. And on board, they had a gyroscope. If you put a gyroscope in an orbit around the Earth, there are two effects that are going to cause a precession of the gyroscope as it orbits around the Earth. One of them is called geodetic precession. That is caused by the gradient of the Newtonian potential of the Earth. The Earth is slightly oblate, and if you move around it, this will introduce a tiny precession, which is this value here. So this is in milliarc seconds per year, and that agrees pretty well with what they measure. The even more interesting effect is the frame dragging effect. The Earth rotates. And what happens if you have a rotating massive object, it drags the space-time with it. And that shows up as a frame, as a precession of the gyroscope that you have on board. And this turned out to be a lot more difficult to measure. People did measure it eventually with some relatively big error bar over here, but it agreed with the predicted value. All of these tests are made in the weak field regime. All of these are done within the solar system, where gravitational fields are pretty weak. There is one big test outside of the solar system, which is performed with double pulsars. Pulsars are absolutely remarkable objects because a pulsar is an incredibly precise clock. And you can observe the radio pulses that are emitted from pulsars, and you can do this to such a precision that is absolutely breathtaking. And this has led to a very nice test of general relativity, but again, this is a weak field test. So let's see what's the idea here. So this particular system here consists of two pulsars that orbit each other. So you have two very precise clocks in a system with an orbital separation of maybe several astronomical units, several AU. And if you assume general relativity, you can predict what the observed signal is. you can predict the orbits of these two objects as they orbit around each other, and you can predict what the change of these orbits due to relativistic effects. This is, first of all, there's this perihelion precession, and you can measure the advance of the periastron in this case. You can measure the advance of this as a function of time, simply by observing the pulse profiles. There is going to be a change in the orbital period because of the emission of gravitational waves. In fact, that's the only detection of gravitational waves that we have so far, an indirect detection where we infer from the derivative of an orbital period that there must be something like gravitational waves. But that's just an aside. Then, of course, you see the time delay. When a pulse profile emitted from one pulsar propagates next to the other pulsar and then reaches the observer, you're able to see a time delay in the signal because it has to pass by this pulsar. And all of these effects turn out to be very nice, and you can measure them. Now, the only thing that you don't know for these pulsars is the masses. You don't know the masses of the two pulsars. So the idea here is the following. Assuming general relativity, you calculate all these various observables as a function of both masses. And then you put them on this diagram, which is called a mass-mass diagram. So you have the mass of one pulsar on the x-axis, and here's the mass of the other pulsar. And then you plot all these various quantities, like the periastron advance, like the change of the orbital period. This is the mass ratio. This gamma measures the time delay of the pulse profiles. And then there's also this R and S, which are two values that are related to the pulse profile themselves. And all of these have to line up in one point because the two pulsars have the same masses for all observables. So, and indeed they do. So the conclusion from this is all of these things were calculated within general relativity. And if they line up in one point, you find masses for either one of these pulsars, then you can conclude that from this general relativity must be right. And the precision is absolutely remarkable. In fact, on this plot, you can't even see it. You have to go to this insert here, and the precision is indeed very remarkable. Now, again, this is a test of weak field general relativity because even though you have all these relativistic effects, the pulsars are separated by quite some distance, which turns it into a weak field effect. So these are the successes. That, you know, I was wondering about that myself. I did not find it in the article where I got this from. So, I have to leave that open. But in any case, there are two conclusions that we can make at this point. First of all, general relativity is very well tested in the weak field regime from solar system and from these double pulsars. However, we can't say anything from this what general relativity might do in the strong field regime, and I'm going to define a little bit more carefully what exactly I mean by this in just a moment. In fact, let's take a look at this. Where actually has general relativity been tested so far, and where is it still an open question? This is a very nice plot which puts all of these things into context. So here on this axis, I plot gravitational potential, which is simply gm, the mass, divided by radius and divided by c squared to make it dimensionless. And on this axis, I plot the space-time curvature, which I simply take to be a scalar in this case, gm over r cubed c squared. These quantities, this is a little bit heuristic because in general relativity, there is no such thing as a gravitational potential of this form. And the curvature is a tensor and not some scalar. However, if you just do this this way, it makes it very intuitive and you can put things into perspective. What I plot in the middle here, and by the way, and you see that this ranges over an enormous range of scales, both in curvature and in potential. You can see that all the tests that have been performed so far are right here in the middle of this diagram. These are the solar system tests, and then the test for the double pulsar that we have over here. As an aside, there are a few other things that are interesting here. There's you can plot a dark energy scale, which is essentially the omega lambda the density of the lambda cosmological constant. You can do this for dark matter, which is where you would expect dark matter to be become important. That would be down here in this diagram for very low curvatures. That's a part of the diagram that I'm not going to talk about today, but it's still very nice to put things into perspective. Of course, you also have things like Planck scale energies that will be all the way up here, which I'm also not going to talk about today. What I want to talk about today is this region over here, because that is where gravitational fields are strong. This is what I call the strong field regime. Strong field regime is when the gravitational potential is roughly equal to one of order unity, as opposed to, say, the pulsars, where it is of the order 10 to the minus 5. The objects that are most interesting here are supermassive black holes. Here's Sagittarius A star, the supermassive black hole in our galactic center. There's active galactic nuclei. All of these are over here. And then there's XRB, which stands for X-ray binaries. So these are black holes of a characteristic mass of about 10 solar masses, which we find in our own galaxy and in other galaxies. And these objects probe the strongest potentials and curvatures in this part of the diagram that we're interested in. And this is a regime where general relativity is practically untested. There are a handful of tests which assess these kinds of objects, but only in very highly specialized setups. They probe very, very model-specific predictions, and it's simply not a generic test. There is no test, no real test of general relativity so far that uses these kinds of the strong field regime and these kinds of objects. But that, however, is something that I'm very interested in, because these objects are right within our own backyard, in our own galaxy. And they provide an environment where we can go and test general relativity in a way where it simply has not been tested been before, ever. No, that's
so something like a test at nuclear and curvature scales of PBMS.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. That's right. If you ever come up with a different theory of gravity, you have to make sure that you do these things right, because these things have been measured. That's right. So that would be maybe somewhere down here. That's a little bit more difficult to put on this block. Okay, so what I want you to take away from this at this point is that there is a need to test general relativity in the strong field regime and to see what happens at these kinds of curvature scales. On the other hand, there are a couple of arguments why we expect general relativity to be not the full picture in the first place. First of all, general relativity is a classical theory, and it's not renormalizable. That's one issue. The other issue is there are singularities, and that's something that we simply don't really know what to do about. General relativity predicts objects like black holes, and these have a singularity at the center. There's the Big Bang singularity, something that is a little bit difficult to interpret what this really means. And there's the cosmological constant problem. You can make an estimate what value would expect for the cosmological constant in general relativity. You can expect it from field theory, and these two values differ by about 120 orders of magnitude. So that's a little bit difficult. From the standpoint of general relativity, the real issue is vacuum fluctuations, because in GR, all forms of energy gravitate. And the moment you have fluctuations from the vacuum, these should show up as a source term at some point. But if you ignore them, that is when you get the calculations that work out. So that's difficult. This is an open question. And of course, there might well be other arguments. So you might speculate whether GR is only an effective theory, maybe of some quantum theory of gravity that we don't really know about yet. But this is something, these are open questions in GR, and something where we expect to see something different from general relativity. Okay, so now let's see, how can you test this? How can you possibly modify general relativity in such a way that it gives you clear predictions that you can compare with observations? So here's the Einstein-Hilbert action, where G is the determinant of the metric, G is, R is the Ricci scalar, cosmological constant, and some physical constants in front of it. So the first thing that you can do is you could change the number of spatial dimensions. This is something that I, again, won't talk about today. I have actually worked out something in this nature, which turns out to be a real strong field test, but that's not going to be the main topic of the discussion today. But this is something that you can do. Something which is similar is maybe you have a different value for the nature constants. And these might actually go hand in hand, because if you go to higher dimensions, you modify, for example, the gravitational constant, and you see some higher dimensional version of this. And that's another way of how you could possibly modify general relativity. Maybe the most interesting one is, of course, well, let's change this part of it. Let's change the dependence of the action on the curvature scalar. And finally, you can add all kinds of things. You can add scalars, tensors, vectors, and who knows. There's a lot that you can add to this. And there's some equivalence between these, between this and the F of R term. And that's kind of the ideas that you can have. I'm going to use none of this. I'm going to do it differently. What I'm doing is what is called a bottom-up approach. I don't worry about the action or the field equations at all. All I require is the Einstein equivalence principle, and I require a space-time metric. So let me explain a little bit what this means. The Einstein equivalence principle is a nice way of putting together all the certain properties of space-time that you would like to have. This is comprised of the weak equivalence principle, which states the equality of inertial and gravitational mass. Then you need local Lorentz invariance, which means that whenever you perform an experiment, it has to be independent of the velocity of your reference frame. You also require local position invariance, which means that whenever you perform an experiment, it has to be independent of the position and of the time when you perform the experiment. And all of these put together is what is sometimes called the Einstein equivalence principle. Then you require a metric. In this case, I want to test GR with black holes, so I need a black hole metric. The Einstein equivalence principle then ensures that whenever a particle propagates in the metric, either a matter particle or a photon, it's going to propagate along geodesics. So with this, I have a prescription how everything moves in my space-time metric. And that is all I need. I do not have to know the underlying field equations. That is something that I don't need. Now let's talk a little bit about why would you do it this way. Suppose you do it the other way. Suppose you do a modification over here, then what you can do is you can calculate top-down, so this will be the top-down approach, you can calculate some observable. This observable is a clear prediction of that particular theory, and you might be able to compare this with observations, and that's fine. The constraint in this case is that a priori you are limited by a particular theory of gravity. And if that turns out to be not the correct theory, then with your observables, you're not able to efficiently predict the correct theory. And right now, we are pretty much in the dark. For quantum theories of gravity or for anything of this nature, many things are being discussed, but this is simply an open question. So the idea is, well, let's do it the other way. Let's say, well, let's start with a metric and see what happens with objects that move about it. And we do this in a parametric way. And by measuring ultimately these parameters, we are able to infer how this kind of modification might look like in the end. So it's the other way around. It's a very practical approach. We have observables, let's calculate them as a function of free parameters, and from this we might ultimately infer something about the big picture. That's the idea. And what I want to test is the key property of black holes, the no-hair theorem. Loosely formulated, the no-hair theorem says that the Kerr solution, the Kerr metric, is the only possible stationary, axisymmetric, asymptotically flat, and vacuum metric in general relativity that has no naked singularities and no closed time-like loops. So there you have it in a nutshell. So this applies to black holes. It says that in general relativity, there is only one possible type of black holes. It has to be a Kerr black hole. And the Kerr metric is the only metric in GR that has all these properties at the same time. This has a very remarkable consequence. It means that black holes are described by only two parameters, mass and spin. In principle, you can also have charge, but for astrophysical black holes, that plays no role because any residual charge would just quickly neutralize. There's even a mechanism how you can create black holes of this nature when a star collapses. If the collapse is either spherical or nearly spherical, then any signature other than these two parameters is radiated away as gravitational waves. So there's a way of producing these black holes in the first place. So the expectation is that all astrophysical black holes are Kerr black holes. However, it doesn't have to be this way. There are other types of black holes, one of which I proposed myself, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it. Different object, a different question that we have is that the Kerr solution is actually not unique to general relativity. It shows up in other theories of gravity as well. So this is something that is also worth investigating. So the idea is, by taking a very clear property of black holes, I'm able to go in and test that property, and from this design a real strong field test of general relativity, which I'm going to show you a little bit later in the talk. What I want to do, in fact, is test the no-hair theorem observationally. And what I'm asking here is the object a Kerr black hole, or is it something else? And something else could be a different kind of black hole. It could be a different kind of star. It could be some object that we don't even know about. It could be a naked singularity. There are a number of options. And this here is the recipe. This is the way of doing this. You take the space-time, and you expand it in its multiple moments. This is an analogy to what we've all seen in classical mechanics or in electromagnetism, where you have, say, a charge distribution. You want to know what the electric potential looks like at some distance from the source. You can expand the distribution in its multiple moments, and that will then give you the potential at some distance. In general relativity, you can do the same thing. However, in general relativity, or in gravity theories, space is curved. So this is significantly more difficult. But it turns out that can be done. The first moment is going to be the mass. The second one is the spin. For a Kerr black hole, that's it. Because all higher order moments are determined in terms of these two, because mass and spin are the only free parameters. So the idea is, let's take the next order moment, the quadrupole moment, which for the Kerr metric is simply minus the spin squared modulus factors of the black hole mass. And then you introduce this free parameter epsilon here, which measures potential deviations from the Kerr metric. And then you can go and check whether your quadrupole moment is really minus the spin squared, in other words, whether epsilon is zero or not. If you measure something where epsilon is not zero, there are two possibilities. If you assume general relativity, then the object is not a black hole. However, if you know otherwise that the object is a black hole, then you know that general relativity breaks down and is incorrect in the strong field regime. This approach was originally developed in the gravitational wave community, starting with Orion in the 90s. And what I'm doing is I use this approach for electromagnetic observations. And that turns out to be a very fruitful endeavor. This is not the only way of doing it. In fact, this is what I did originally. Later on, it turns out that you can parametrize your metric in a slightly different way, which gives you a little bit more freedom. But this general idea of introducing another free parameter, this is still the strategy that I'm going to follow here. So now let's look at this a little bit more carefully. How would you do this? So again, here's our no-hair theorem. And let's take a look at the properties that we want to keep and those where we want to see if we see something different. So Kerr solution is the only stationary axisymmetric asymptotically flat metric. Stationary, that's certainly something that we want. We don't want the black hole to be time dependent. We want the black hole to be there tomorrow as well. Axisymmetric is fine. This is not an absolute requirement. In this theorem, actually, it turns out that you can drop the term axisymmetric as a consequence of Hawking's rigidity theorem. Hawking showed that if a black hole is stationary, it's either axisymmetric or static. And in that case, it's spherically symmetric. So you could even get rid of this. However, if you modify this, then Hawking's theorem does no longer hold necessarily. And axisymmetric is just a useful thing to keep. It makes things a little bit easier. Certainly, we want asymptotically flat and the correct Newtonian limit, because we know that if you go to the weak field limit of the theory, you want to have the correct Newtonian limit, and in fact, you want to be in accordance with these solar system tests that I showed you earlier. So that's something that we want. What we don't necessarily need is vacuum solution in general relativity, and what we can talk about is what I call pathologies. These are these things, naked singularities, closed time-like loops, outside of the event horizon. So let's first talk about vacuum in GR. If you have a vacuum metric in general relativity, this is not going to describe a black hole unless it is the Kerr metric, precisely because of the Noether theorem. So if you want to have a black hole solution, you have to drop this requirement. And in fact, you say that your metric is a vacuum solution, but of a different theory of gravity. In general relativity, it's non-vacuum. There's a source term. But that is not the real interpretation that I'm interested in. So vacuum in GR is one thing that we can debate. The other one is pathologies. This actually depends on the application, what exactly you want to use your metric for. And I'm going to show you in a moment what this means. The real upshot of this is that we are in strong field gravity. You cannot use some post-Newtonian expansion. You have to modify the entire space-time. You have to redesign the whole thing. You have to do it in such a way that it's consistent and that you can make clear predictions that you can test against observations. And we call this parametric deviations from the Kerr metric. And those, broadly speaking, fall into two categories depending on the application. If you want to look at gravitational waves, you need these deviations that have certain properties. You need something where the space-time is approximately integrable. That's simply a requirement which ensures that you can simply calculate the things that you want to calculate. In this case, what you find is that usually you have pathologies outside of the event horizon, but those don't matter in this case because you look at gravitational waves which you see far away from the source. In my case, I'm interested in accretion flows. So this is highly relativistic plasma orbiting around black holes, which is right at the edge of the event horizon. So I have to make sure that my space-time is regular everywhere outside of the event horizon. I cannot have any of these pathologies. And just to give you an idea what can happen, this is from a paper which is coming out very shortly, where we look at one particular metric that does not have this property. So here what I'm showing you, this is a cut through the black hole, this is the equatorial plane, this is the polar axis here, and I'm showing you for some particular value of the spin, the location of the event horizon, which is this black curve here, all of these colored curves are coordinate singularities that show up in this metric. And what you can see is that, well, this is somewhat near the event horizon, but it's always outside, which means that you cannot use this particular space-time to describe your physics just outside of the event horizon. Now you might say, well, okay, but this is really very close to the event horizon. Why is this a problem? Well, it is a problem because I want to look at accretion flows. Accretion flows, if you recall, for accretion flows end at what is called the innermost stable circular orbit. This is a circular orbit around a black hole. And inside of this, you can no longer support a particle on a circular orbit. It's just going to spiral in. If you increase the spin, this circular orbit is going to merge eventually with the event horizon. It becomes arbitrarily close. So if you have a situation like this, where you have pathologies outside of the event horizon, you can only do this up to some value of the spin. Because if you go higher, then you hit these pathologies and you can no longer describe your accretion flow self-consistently. Turns out, ultimately, that you can do this only for black holes that have either small or some intermediate spin. And that's the real limitation, because most of the astrophysical objects that, of the black holes that we know about have a high spin. So that limits us from accessing most of the data that, that we have out there. So this is a real issue. And you could even have more. So there's, which I show over here, you can have regions where Lorentz symmetry is violated. You can have close time-like curves. And all of these things can happen outside of the event horizon. So you want to make sure that for these kinds of applications, for accretion flows, that you don't run into these issues for your metric. If you look at gravitational waves, that's fine, because there you are far away from the event horizon. You have some supermassive black hole, some small object spirals into the black hole, and you can follow this and infer the space-time from it. If you do this, then you're not interested in what happens just outside of the event horizon. So for this, this is fine. And in fact, this metric was designed for that particular application. But for what I'm interested in, accretion flows, there I can no longer use a metric of this kind, and there are a number of those. I have to do something else.
Sir, you said you wanted a stationary black hole, so when you mentioned the more gravitational waves?
Oh. Yeah, that's right. I'm thinking of Emery's, and I believe, well, that's the kind of metric that they use for this. So I'm thinking of where you have still a large distance from the black hole, not the final merger phase.
Don't you still need to have, so in the Emery's, right, they do this in some sort of perturbative expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they intrinsically do this, but don't you still need to have some boundary condition modification near the horizon that hides the pathologies? If you were going to do it Exactly right, because you get scattering, which is the rate of things off the pathology. You're just setting incoming boundary conditions to the black hole horizon, except if the pathologies are outside of that. Maybe you want to set incoming ingoing boundary conditions at the surface that contains the pathologies or something. Yeah, but then it's not clear that it should be incoming, right? Because if it is outside of the horizon, it could be off. So just setting incoming boundary conditions maybe messing up with the physics.
Well, this ambiguity, but I'm just saying it doesn't also persist with gravitational waves. You would go to, you know, if you do solid exact, I guess if you do perturbatively, then it's not such a big issue. Now, if you do it perturbatively within GR, then you would be in the boundary of the horizon, and there you say everything's coming, or inside the horizon, because you have a regular structure.
If you only calculate the Emery's, you are still at large distances, like hundreds of gravitational radii or maybe even thousands. And what happens right at the event horizon is just not that important.
Yeah, but that's using a quadrupole formula or something like that.
Yeah, so that only works for some.
Ignores wave optics effects.
Yeah, that's right. It only works. So you have to do that perturbatively. That's right. Okay, so the framework that I'm using is this one. This is what I designed myself. This is a metric which I can use for arbitrary values of the spin, that's critical, and which is regular everywhere outside of the event horizon. Just to give you a quick idea what happens here, so you may recognize this as the Kerr metric, and then there's this function h, which is inserted at certain non-trivial places, and it is done in such a way, h is over here, it is done in such a way to ensure that this metric has exactly the properties that I'm interested in. And this is the final answer. If you derive this kind of, if you construct this kind of metric, you make a very specific ansatz, you do complex coordinate transformations, and you do a number of tricks and coordinate transformations, ultimately you arrive at a metric that looks like this. Right now, this is the only metric of this kind that exists within which we can interpretate these observations of accretion flows. Other metrics that are out there, you always have the situation that either you have these kind of pathologies, or it only works for very small perturbations around a Kerr black hole. This one, I can make the perturbations, this parameter epsilon 3 here, which measures the deviation. I can make it large, and it still describes a space-time with the properties that I need in order to carry out my framework. So this is a framework for testing general relativity in the strong field regime. I have a free parameter. I have a framework which is self-consistent. Now I can go and calculate observables in this framework and compare it to the observations that I'm able to make. And I'm doing this for across the electromagnetic spectrum for several different applications. And it turns out that this actually works very well. So this is what I'm going to show you for the rest of the talk. How are we doing with time?
We have about 12 minutes, okay.
Very good. So I have a framework. Now let's look at applications. Oh, I mean, up to, let me show you a figure of this. Let me go ahead. This is the location of the ISCO as a function of spin, as a function of epsilon 3. And I do this for ranges of the spin between minus 1 and 1. So this is the usual range within GR. If I go to higher values of the spin, what happens is that the event horizon disappears and it becomes a naked singularity. I mean, you could still do that, but those things have kind of weird properties. And so that is what I mean by arbitrary values of the spin.
So that spin parameter is it still interpretable as the spin parameter in the black hole?
Yeah.
Even regardless of what age it is.
That's right. It is, and you make sure you can systematically show that it's still the spin, and that's something that I did. It's important, however, that you have that. Same with the mass. You have to make sure that this m. Yes, that's right. That's how you do that. Okay, so let me just skip through this. I want to test you, show you briefly three main applications that I'm working on. This is a project where we want to look at the black hole at the galactic center, where we want to take an image of the black hole. This is something that, let's put it this way. So this is what I've been working on together with Avery. It has been known that the shape of this shadow, as it's called, depends uniquely on the mass, the spin, and the inclination of an accretion disk. And I showed that this is also uniquely true if you introduce this kind of deviation from the Kerr metric. And you can use this as a clear signature to test general relativity by looking at objects of this kind. And then we plug this into Avery's code, and we calculated images of black holes and see what happens if you change this parameter epsilon. So let me just go straight to the relevant figure here. This is the data that we have currently from observations from the galactic center, which I plot here as a function of spin and this deviation parameter epsilon. The most likely value of epsilon, of spin and epsilon is actually over here, which is a very small spin, but a non-zero value of epsilon. This is what we infer from the current data. You can see that value of zero for epsilon is still consistent at high probability, but the highest probability is what we have over here. Future observations with a larger telescope array is going to make these measurements a lot more precise, and we're able to pin this down. But for now, this is what we have. That is something that's right. That's a very important question. It's something that we are talking about very intensely. For this plot, I assume one particular flow geometry. And I say, given this flow geometry, that is what you get. Whether that geometry turns out to be the real picture, that's of course something that we look at from several different angles. But for now, that's the answer that we have. Okay. In the interest of time, I'm going to, well, this is obviously what we are using in Endeavour, called the Event Horizon Telescope, where we have where we couple together a number of radio telescopes across the planet, use them as one big interferometer, and then we are able to achieve these kinds of resolutions that we need in order to resolve the galactic center at micro-arc second scale. Oh, it's called a South Pole telescope. It's a 10 meter telescope, and that provides the longest and most interesting baselines. Okay. I really wanted to focus on the first part of my talk because that laid out the gravity aspect of it, but actually I have a very well developed observables which I can show you. These are movies that we made, where I show you, well, what happens to the image of the black hole if you change the parameters. Here what I'm changing is the inclination, and the properties that I'm most interested in here is this bright ring which surrounds the black hole, because that turns out to be a very nice signature that we can use to infer the parameters of a black hole. If you just change the inclination, you see that this ring here does actually not change at all, except for very low inclinations where you can't see it. But otherwise, this ring is not affected by inclination. That's one important point to take away from this.
So can you explain that? So it's not affected by inclination?
Yeah, I will.
There's a variation there, so.
That's right. Oh, okay, let me come back to this in a second. On the other hand, if you change the spin of a black hole, what you find is that this ring here remains nearly circular. It only is displaced in the image plane. Finally, if you change this epsilon parameter, you see that the ring shape becomes asymmetric and clearly different from anything that you could have in general relativity. So this is a smoking gun. If we see something like this, you cannot do this with a Kerr black hole. And now coming back to your question, what I showed here in about 2 years ago, if I plot the diameter of this ring as a function of spin for a whole bunch of different values of all the other parameters, the ring diameter is constant. And this is what the first movie was supposed to show. I could do this for the displacement, which turns out to depend on the spin times the sine of the inclination. And I can do it for the asymmetry of the ring, which now depends linearly on this epsilon parameter. And I can use it to measure these parameters of a black hole and to go and test the Noether theorem. So here we have a real approach of how we can do this. And this is currently underway. I worked this out in detail already, what we can do with the mass. These big ellipses here are current mass measurements. If you couple this with an array of this size, these ellipses would look like this. This is the kind of measurement that we expect, which looks very nice. And we can infer the parameters of the black hole from this kind of measurement. So this is very exciting. Okay, for the last few minutes, let me show you two other observables. One thing that we're interested in is ion lines. So you have your accretion flow around the black hole. Ion is an element which is very abundant, and it shows up as a broad line, which you see over here. So this is a spectrum, essentially count rates as a function of energy, and you have a huge continuum. But on top of this, you see these broad humps, which correspond to these ion lines. And if you subtract the background, this is how these lines look like. And it turns out that the shape of these lines depends characteristically on the parameters of a black hole. And this is what I simulated. We wrote a ray tracing code for this, where the shape of the line depends uniquely on the values of your black hole. And here I'm plotting this for several different values of this parameter epsilon. And you see that the line shapes can be significantly different. And this is something that we can use as a probe now for different sources to go and test the Noether theorem. Because this works for galactic black holes, so this is smaller mass black holes. This works for AGN, which are kiloparsecs, megaparsecs away. And even could tell you what kind of precision we need for future experiments, but I'm going to skip this. The last point that I want to make at the end right now is there is a characteristic modes that you can excite in your accretion flow. This is called quasi-periodic variability. These are modes that show up at very characteristic frequencies, and they're relatively bright. So we see these for a number of objects. And there are several models for these kinds of QPOs, as they are called, quasi-periodic oscillations. These models incorporate the space-time of a black hole. So by measuring these characteristic frequencies, the hope is to infer the properties of a black hole from these. And this could be relatively clean and independent from all the various properties of your accretion flow. So this is a very nice approach. Right now, there are a number of different models that people have proposed. And at this point, we don't really know what the correct model is because that's very difficult to do. What I did is I analyzed this for two particular models. This is something which I'm working on right now, where I use data that we have from RXTE, which is an X-ray satellite, and infer values of the spin and this deviation parameter under certain assumptions. So one is for one model, one is for the other model. And I'm inferring these constraints using current data. RXTE is a very nice satellite. The next step of this is what is called LOFT. This is a conference that I went to last week. LOFT is one out of five missions proposed for the next medium-sized mission for ESA's Cosmic Vision Program. It's going to absolutely revolutionize black hole science as a colossal collecting area, and is going to achieve the timing resolution that we need in order to resolve these QPOs properly and to really perform tests of this nature. So this is something which is very exciting. And as I said, it's one out of five, and the decision will be made next year. It's a couple of arc seconds, micro arc seconds. The timing resolution is microseconds. Microseconds. Okay, so let me wrap this up at this point. I want to do observational tests of the Noether theorem of general relativity. I've shown you in great length a framework that I developed that I can use to perform these tests, and I can do this across the electromagnetic spectrum. We do this for imaging of the galactic center at submillimeter wavelengths. We do this at high energies with fluorescent ion lines with satellites like AstroH, or maybe something like Athena or something of that kind. And finally, quasi-periodic variability, where LOFT is going to open the window and really make this possible. And then we could see if general relativity is correct in the strong field regime or whether we are for a big surprise. Thanks.
So there's been a number of questions throughout the talk, and in the interest of time, maybe one question.
You worked out what sorts of values epsilon takes in for different modified gravity?
That's very difficult to do. Because, as you recall, the idea was to not settle on specific theories. Yes, that's right. That's right. I have not done this for my particular metric.
Okay. So, when you find GR, there it's much easier to, black holes are stable. As you said, there are a number of fields in which you have the same black hole solutions as in GR, where it's much easier to modify neutron stars or places where you have matter. So, are there any future observations that could be used to test GR?
Yes. And in fact, a second graduate student of my advisor, of my former advisor, is using my framework for neutron stars. So one thing that you can look at is the characteristic pulse profiles for pulsars, or generally the emission from neutron stars. And it turns out that these things do, in fact, depend on the quadrupole moment. The metrics are a little bit different for neutron stars because it's not a black hole. But it turns out that you can still go ahead and use this precisely for the idea that you have.
Neutron stars, you do have a quadrupole emission, so you think.
Yes. And in fact, right now, the development stage is one step before that. The framework that I showed you, that is what we use to describe the quadrupole moment properly. Because up to now, people have usually used numerical space-times because you simply couldn't calculate it. But this provides a way of doing this analytic thing.
All right, let's thank Tim again.